back it up.
I don't believe there was any mention of it specifically in the post-conviction petition, but as far as the experts, the requirement of needing an expert, we go to appellant's argument that he didn't have the financial resources, and that lack was enough to get him over that hurdle. But if you take this idea that appellant proposes, this novel exception saying that if you don't have the financial resources, you can wait more than 2 years, and once you have the money, then you get a new exception to the time bar. If we expanded this to general post-conviction petitions, a person in prison could wait 10, 20, 30 years until they finally saved enough of their meager earnings to hire an expert to attack any facet of their conviction. And by that time, the evidence, the witnesses, the state's ability to defend against that collateral attack would be completely destroyed.
Ms. Meyer, you would agree, though, that the posture of this case is a little different because you had a situation where you had charges that were brought, and then after all the evidence had been brought in, including defendant's evidence, the state switched the charges, amended the charges, and to make matters worse, the jury rejected the original charges that were brought, but actually convicted him of the new charges, including the new two assault charges. So you're already starting from a position where the defendant is really has his back to the wall in terms of, you know, he never had an opportunity to present any defense or much less any evidence in the trial itself. I mean, doesn't that really favor the interest of justice argument?
So I would disagree with the characterization of the trial that way. If you look back to the way this court characterized the trial in the 2009 decision, and if you read the trial transcripts, it's clear that defense counsel at trial had repeatedly discussed the idea of adding these so-called, at the time, lesser included charges. Now, both defense counsel and the state and the district court was mistaken, because assault charge is not a lesser included of the charged offenses, but everyone at the table at that time believed they were, and they were acting in response to that belief, which is why this court found there was no prejudice requiring reversal, because defendant was preparing for trial with the belief that he was going to ask for these lesser included charges. They had lots of discussions about it. It's reflected in the transcript. And in the end, he told his attorney that he didn't want them included. And then the state said, well, we want them included, even though because they thought they would be included by defense, but then they weren't. So the state asked that they be included. So yes, Judge Larkin.
So I just wanted to follow up on the argument you're making, because I'm looking on my other screen at this court's decision in the 2009 case in which we affirmed the conviction. And obviously there is no petition for rehearing in this court. We're not going to second guess, you know, what we did back then. However, I do note that although we said it was error and everyone conceded it was error, we didn't give relief because, quote unquote, Anderson has failed to show any way in which he was denied the opportunity to prepare his defense as a result of the added charges. He asserts that he would have adjusted or fine-tuned his strategy, but he did not explain how. And I mean, I can't help going back to 2009 and asking, why didn't he explain then that, oh, had I known this, I would have hired a ballistics expert, and perhaps that person could have given testimony that would have disputed the trajectory testimony from the state. And, you know, Mr. Longstorff obviously can respond to this, but this is a hurdle I'm having with this case. It's like over 10 years ago, we said, he's failed to tell us how this hurt him, and now we're hearing, well, it hurt him. I don't understand why we didn't have this argument back then, even if he did not have at that time the expert teed up to provide the testimony.
I would respond that this was never part of the facts of the case. There was never any dispute about the ballistics because defendant testified, I shot them, I shot the bullets. But he claimed he shot them in self-defense, relying on this idea that even though he fired the gun in this crowded bar it wasn't his fault that people got injured. And he never, basically this court in 2009 said, well, you didn't give us this information. And ever since then, every time the court says, you didn't do this, appellant has come up with a way to say, well, here it is. But that's not the way finality of convictions work. Anytime this court says, this was an error at trial, appellant doesn't get to respond with, that error caused this injustice. And then when you say, well, that injustice wasn't enough to reverse the case, he can't come back with, oh, but that injustice caused this injustice. You have a set amount of time in which to come up with these arguments. And even if appellant didn't do it at trial, he had 2 years from the date of trial to formulate this argument in any form, and he failed to do so. And then 2 years after that, he had a 2 year period to bring any of these arguments up in a post-conviction petition, and he failed to do that. And from the state's perspective, the most egregious failure is in 2015. Appellant did not raise these issues on his subsequent post-conviction petition. He waited an additional 2 years after the post-conviction court denied those issues, where he had lay witness testimony or affidavits. He had a new argument about how this was an injustice done to him. The post-conviction court denied it. This court affirmed that. And then he comes up with yet another argument. And this is exactly the type of situation the post-conviction law was designed to prevent. The victims in this case, 15 years later, still do not have finality. The state is still reaching out to them through advocates and saying, your case is back up in front of the Court of Appeals. Appellant mentioned that his client was disadvantaged right away. And I would disagree with that characterization. Appellant at trial was represented by counsel. Appellant could have sought ballistic information evidence, but that wasn't the facts of the case. After that, the minute during the direct appeal that his counsel realized that this error had occurred, they could have stayed the proceeding, asked for a post-conviction hearing. At that point, present newly discovered evidence. And we still do not have a reason why that could not or should not have happened. That was the appropriate time to attack this conviction, was within 2 years of this court's 2009 decision. When this court said, we don't have that evidence, that's when appellant should have brought forward this evidence and not waited an additional decade. The second claim that appellant raised below was that he was denied the right to a fair trial because of the addition of these non-lesser included charges. In addition to being untimely, this claim represents how appellant refuses to follow this idea of finality in the post-conviction statute. This is an identical argument to what appellant raised on direct appeal and in his 2015 post-conviction petition, meaning this court has already affirmed denial of this claim. So this second claim is NAFLA barred as well as being untimely. And then finally, to address the third claim appellant raised, which is a standalone interest of justice claim. He also raised this claim in 2017, and this court denied it, stating, quote, we are foreclosed from addressing its merits because we lack the supervisory powers necessary to do so. The Supreme Court, not this court, holds the inherent supervisory authority to which he alludes. And the long footnote on page 7 in appellant's reply brief demonstrates this amply, as all the cases he cites are Minnesota Supreme Court cases. Appellant can once again ask the Minnesota Supreme Court to review this case, but they rejected his request in 2009 and again in 2017, and no exceptional circumstances have arisen since that time. So in conclusion, the post-conviction court did not abuse its discretion. And it's important to note that is the standard we are here under, abuse of discretion by a district court who followed clearly established law. So that district court did not abuse its discretion by again denying appellant's claims. Appellant had opportunities to address these issues previously, and he failed to prevail. At this time, there is no longer any legal basis for his continuing challenges to his convictions. If there are no further questions, I ask that you affirm the post-conviction court's decision.
Thank you, counsel. I don't see any additional questions. Mr. Longstorff, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And perhaps could you address the issue I raised, that being that, you know, your theory underlying the new evidence claim seems to have been available back in 2009, even if you had not yet retained an expert to advance that claim. Counsel, you'll need to unmute your microphone. No worries.
I apologize again. I'd like to start just with the opposing counsel, you know, said that essentially all the parties acted like the assault counts were going to be part of this case, and that was always the way it went. But I would just point out that essentially, at least in our view, the trial counsel stands up and makes an opening statement about through and through, and that's really the only place that came up in trial. And if the assault charges were part of the case, then I think you'd expect at least there to have been some discussion on the record about Mr. Anderson agreeing that a counsel was going to essentially admit all of the elements of assault. You don't see that, and I think that kind of underlies the idea that Mr. Anderson's put forward, that these weren't part of the case and he didn't expect that. Now, as far as why these specific arguments weren't made on direct appeal, we're not exactly certain why that was the case, but what we've shown is that, and I think, you know, in the 2017 Court of Appeals opinion addressing the interest of justice argument made sort of to the Supreme Court, the author of that opinion said certainly the argument that Mr. Anderson presents now is more compelling than what was presented in his direct appeal. And that's sort of where he's been coming from on this thing the whole time, is that we don't have just one thing where it's only the financial inability to do it. He has the fact that these charges were added late. I think the case, you know, there's this argument or this idea that everybody knew the assault was there, but I don't think the record really bears that out. And so the combination of the late notice and the lack of financial ability are what really set this case apart in our view from other cases seeking review in the interest of justice. And I just note that there's the idea that there's time bars and procedural bars that are put in place. And I agree that those exist. And part of the reason we have that is to get this finality. But the reason we can do that is because we have a record in a case that's created for the specific charges and for the specific arguments. And we can look back, apply that record to the case and see if it fits or not. When you have this case with a notice like this, it doesn't fit. The record wasn't created for assault charges. And especially where is this idea. Yes.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I just had a question. Are there any claims, are there any new claims that are brought in this post-conviction petition appeal that are different than any claims that have been brought at any time in the past?
Well, I think that the claims have the same legal basis in that Mr. Anderson has been consistently fighting to show the prejudice. What's new is the facts that he has to support them. And just to finish up that.
All these claims have been raised and have been adjudicated before then, correct?
Well, I'm not certain that they've actually been adjudicated, because previously in 2007, there was considered time barred and procedurally barred. And the court noted that the claims seemed more compelling, I think was maybe the language used, but they couldn't address them because of the procedural and time bar, which is why Mr. Anderson has now sought out this review with the forensic expert to show that there were more concrete ways to do it. And he's explained exactly why he couldn't bring this claim earlier. And ultimately our position is that when all the facts are considered, it would be appropriate to review the merits of this claim under the interest of justice. Thank you.
Thank you to both of the attorneys for your arguments. You will have our decision within 90 days as required by statute. That concludes the hearing.